America is, in almost all contexts worldwide, a country and a political system that people are paying attention to, that people are interested in, that people know things about.
So, yeah, I think most people aren't necessarily like that ideologically rigid in their positions, which again then reinforces this idea of making the media important, because if everybody is still up for grabs, then even more election campaigning, even more moving around the country. So
I think that there is an argument that the entire nature of the Constitution in the US could be seen in some ways as anti-democratic.
Hello and welcome to Civics and Cynics, the podcast of the Hasso-Plattner Institute's Digital Technology, Governance and Policy Research Group. In this special episode, Professor Dr. Estariel de la Paz, Professor and Principal Investigator of the Hasso-Plattner Institute's Digital Technology, Governance and Policy Research Group, and Dr. Jamie Ranger, postdoctoral researcher in the same research group, come together to explore the nuanced question, is the United States still a democracy? We hope you enjoy the thought-provoking discussion that follows.
I'm really glad to finally be in the studio to record this, because I've been looking over and working with, as I guess an executive editor role, the previous podcasts that we've been doing, but this is the first time that I have appeared on the podcast as a, you know, speaker rather than someone who's looking over it. So it's fun to be in the recording studio and to talk about what we're talking about today. You proposed the topic of talking about whether the US can be considered a democracy. Is it currently? Was it ever? And I thought that was a great thing that it would be really exciting for us both to talk about, because we have such good and interesting conversations about this kind of thing normally.
Yeah, well, let's hope it continues. Yes. I appreciate that you're no longer a disembodied voice of authority, which is, it's always nice to have you here with us. I think, well, obviously a lot of things have happened since the last time we spoke about America. So obviously, like, I don't know if you guys have checked the news, but Trump won. So in that context, there was a lot of, will America still be a democracy by the time he's finished with the institutions? Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of naturally raised the question of, well, has America ever been a democracy? What does it mean for something to be a democracy? How do political scientists and the international community think about what democracy is versus how political theory thinks about democracy, and why it's important to hold, you know, certain states to higher standards than others. And I suppose that, like, naturally brings us onto this idea of, like, well, let's just start with the most obvious thing, which is, like, why is it important that we are chatting about America at all, given that we're, you know, we're currently in Germany. I'm not American, but I feel I have strong opinions about America. Why do I have them? I suppose it'd be a nice, you know, operating.
I mean, that's exactly the answer, right? That you have strong opinions about America. That America is, in almost all contexts worldwide, a country and a political system that people are paying attention to, that people are interested in, that people know things about. And this is the very reason why it is important to discuss the US's democracy, because they are both intentionally and sometimes a bit unintentionally, but mostly intentionally, trying to set the standard for what a democracy means. You know, we talk about in political science so many different kinds of democracy, liberal democracies, representative democracies. You know, I've done a lot of work in China that sometimes calls itself like a socialist democracy, right? And that the US is on the world stage putting out sort of a stamp saying, we are the bastions of democracy. You know, when they go into other countries in their international, I'm trying to say this in a circumspect way.
One of us has to be reasonable.
So yeah. But that they put themselves out on the world stage, as the protectors of democracy, of the supporters of democracy, but that the vision of democracy that they're putting forward is a particularly personal one to the US and one that isn't flawed in many ways. So while many of the things that we probably talk about today that are problems with the US democracy may also be problems in other countries, we are specifically talking about the US in this podcast and its version of democracy and whether it is a good democracy or not, because it's so powerfully trying to shape the understanding of what a democracy means.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it goes down to, I mean, should we go straight into the history? Because I think in terms of defining democracy, I think there's kind of two, I think, mainstream ways of looking at it. So one is, if we're cutting the world up into democracies and non-democracies for the sake of political science, there are some countries that are obviously more democratic than others. I think there's the historical context of the fact, especially in the post-war period, being a democracy is generally considered good. If you can convince people that you're a democracy and your fellow, of your fellow states that you're doing democratic processes is considered morally good, normatively advantageous, allows you to, you know, acquire resources more easily in the kind of international market, and also just reduces the chances of anybody else trying to get involved in your affairs. And then you've got the kind of political theory definition of democracy, which starts with things like the formal legal equality that they expect the institutions to abide by, the kind of idea of rule of law, which again can operate technically in the absence of democracy, with the exception of the one guy in charge of the rule of law, I guess. But also this idea of the foundational substantive idea that all citizens should be treated equally or considered equals in terms of moral worth. Historically speaking, the historical conversation in America is obviously that it was never really set up before everyone to be considered equal, which is kind of the boring criticism, but kind of the necessary one. So obviously we've got the initial dispossession of Native Americans and their land and territories and their culture. We have the transatlantic slave trade and the enduring legacy of racism there. We have the new racisms they invented in the kind of 18th, the kind of 19th century, the kind of we'll be racist against the Irish and the Italians, and we'll create a racial categorization based on whiteness, but that whiteness will be kind of ephemeral and move around strategically depending on where you are in the world and what else is happening in the world. And then we just have gender, of course. There's obviously gender inequalities in all democracies. And then, of course, you've got the substantial problem of wealth in America. There's massive wealth inequality. The rich obviously have more of a say than the poor, and that's been a problem since its initial foundations.
Which has now been, and I think we'll get to this later, but almost structurally and legally now built into the US system. This influence and unequal influence of money perpetuates itself in that you have people with unequal resources then having unequal access to the political process, then structurally creating and influencing a political process in which those processes, with things like PACs, with the Citizens United decision that allowed that said that corporations have the same free speech rights as individuals and therefore can make unlimited campaign donations, that this inequality then has now been baked into the system and is called democracy.
Absolutely. And I think, and people often make voting decisions based on the kind of political feasibility of policies that are proposed. A lot of people will tend to vote on the idea of who's the candidate that can convince people other than me of their candidacy. And sometimes that process itself involves stuff like who can get the most lobby money and who can get the most media support, which itself kind of creates this kind of vicious cycle.
Yeah.
What's the kind of first big topic you want to kind of take?
Yeah, well, I think actually just going back to the way that you are talking about defining democracy and these sort of foundational things of inequality that are built into the system and many of our democratic systems, right? The gendered inequality and women not having the right to vote until a long time after men, and people who did not own property not having the right to vote and a long time after people who were property owners, all of these kinds of things being part of democratic systems are you know, common. But I think when you were talking about that, I think it's useful also to go back to this very trite kind of idea of democracy as rule by the people.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea that partly, I think it's interesting when you are constructing your democratic system, you can say in one way, this system is not democratic because women are excluded, people of color are excluded, you know, people with criminal convictions are excluded. But also, you can kind of turn it on its head when you're saying these are the people who are allowed to rule. You were kind of saying who were full people, like who were full citizens. And you can look at this in one way and say, like, democracy means rule by the people, and therefore we don't have an equality of the people in rule, therefore this is not a democracy. But you can also kind of look at it in the other way in terms of saying, like, in structuring who is allowed to participate in the democracy, we are making statements about who or who is not a full person.
Absolutely, yeah. And just on that topic, I mean, whenever, I don't know if you've ever been in an argument with someone on the internet and then they've tried to win by saying, well, America isn't a democracy, it's a constitutional republic. Like this kind of smug response. It's like, just to unpack that slightly, there is something in the fact that the original constitutional makeup of the United States is set up to kind of reduce the problem of crowds, the problem of the mob. Like there's a lot of stuff about the importance of making sure that, well, the electoral college system itself, I mean, which we should get into now, is essentially set up on the principle that because the population of America was changing so rapidly, they wanted to ensure that like high quality candidates and high quality ideas would not be affected by the whims of the majority and all this kind of stuff. And that there'd be equal power between, you know, the small, richer, well, at the time it would have been the northern states, and then as bigger swathes of land and as, you know, the mass movement of people to different parts of the states emerged, that the northern states that set up the original idea would still have disproportionate influence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just like speaks on that idea.
Yeah. I mean, I think also I sometimes draw the illusion that we should think of the US in its founding and the way that it was sort of designed as a system, not in the way it evolved, almost more in the way if we think of the EU. Like it was almost more thought of as when it was first founded as this collection of independent states that are then brought together at a federal level over a much, much smaller number of like monetary and international policy decisions. And that in some ways, you know, this is really, really diverged. And what you've had is like a conglomeration of power at the state level through like the Interstate Commerce Clause that's now, you know, expanded to mean that like the Congress can regulate interstate commerce and therefore can regulate almost anything because it kind of touches on money, which kind of touches on interstate commerce, but that it almost could have gone much more of the way that we see the EU and many of the structural problems, talking about the Electoral College, and the differences between the way that voting works in states, are perhaps down to this idea that it wasn't founded in the same way as like a centralized democracy. It was much more founded kind of like we think of the EU.
Yeah. When you mentioned the EU analogy, I was like, oh, America is a steel and iron racket that got out of hand quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
a little bit.
Yeah. It was a cotton producing racket.
Yeah. Yeah.
An international cotton trade producing racket. And a bunch of religious
specialists,
freedom immigrants, but then got out of hand and decided that they needed the rest of had the divine right to expand across the rest of the entire country, and then needed to find a way to rule it.
Okay, so we've complained about America and its historical foundations. We pointed out the kind of analysis of the fact that it didn't really start as what we consider a fully fledged democracy, Thomas Paine and John Locke and other influences on those initial documents might. So a patriotic American who believes America is a democracy quite reasonably could say to us, okay, cool, you've said all that, but we're in the modern world. We fixed all that. We did the Voting Rights Act of 1964. All the states are all hanging out now. People... you know, move freely from state to state, and you know, it's a prosperous nation. How dare you accuse us of not being a democracy? What kind of arguments would you deploy? This guy's to respond to this gentleman that I've created in my head.
Sir, would you like another iced tea? I mean, what right do I have? I mean, it's the, you know, the degrees in political science, and of course this is a valid point, but it's also never really, you know, it's never really valid to push off criticism without engaging with it, right?
Mm-hmm.
The excuse, why are you critiquing me? Go critique someone who is worse, you know, is always like a hollow excuse. But yeah, I guess more specifically, you mentioned already the legacies of slavery with structural inequality and institutional racism. That has, you know, there's just so many examples here. I don't even know the way to go, but the way that this is brought forward, for instance, to use an example, in the policing and then the laws around people with criminal convictions.
Yes, of course.
Being able to vote. So you have laws that criminalize Black communities more than white communities. You know, you have in many cases much higher penalties for blue collar crime compared to white collar crime. Yeah. You know, these examples around much more strict prison sentences for crack cocaine compared to, you know, normal cocaine, which is just, you know, largely related to
who's buying it.
Who's buying it. And then greater police presence within high crime areas. Like the Supreme Court has ruled in certain cases that whether the same action takes place in a high crime area versus a low crime area is part of the context as the amount of rights that person has. You know, whether you had reasonable suspicion to search someone doing a particular activity depends on whether they're in a quote-unquote high crime as opposed to low crime.
Redlining,
low crime area. But then this comes back structurally in the number of laws that prevent people with criminal convictions from voting. It's different in different states, but I think Florida's is particularly harsh. So once you have a criminal conviction, I think in particular felonies, again, different for every state, you are then not allowed to vote, sometimes until that is expunged off your record. There were also instances in which people who had criminal convictions didn't know that they weren't eligible to vote. Voted.
Turned up voting and went to prison, yeah.
Yeah, and then were convicted for voter fraud. So the way that these inequalities in the founding of the system are not transparently and with some sense of
redress.
When they're not actually like redressed proactively, it's not enough simply to say like, well, there's an even playing field now, because you didn't start with an even playing field, that these then are built into the system. Just use one example.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I mean, the issue of the past is that the present is determined by what happened in the past, and if there's not any active and proactive redressing of all these initial inequalities, then they're going to persist. And I think that's why people gesture to these initial foundational inequalities, because there has been no sustained attempt, at least at a national scale, to do any kind of full redress. Formal equality has been achieved, brackets with caveats, because they kind of partially revised some of the laws around the Voting Rights Act to make it easier for gerrymandering and voter suppression. But let's imagine a situation. Let's keep it nice and theoretical. Why not? So let's imagine a situation where all this stuff is redressed. What kind of enduring issues does American democracy have? So, like, I would suggest, and this is me getting on my theory hat on, is that there's an issue of the weak presidency,
mm-hmm.
which is a kind of old theory from the early 60s by a guy called Robert Neustadt. And his argument is ostensibly, well, in the context of the states, well, let's use Trump as an example, actually, because he's actually, you know, he's popular, right? He wins the popular vote. To win the popular vote doesn't necessarily mean You win the Electoral College, so you can win the popular vote and lose.
A number of recent presidents. Trump, exactly. 2016.
So you go, you're popular president, you run for president, you win, you get in, you sit down. And Neustadt's theory is ostensibly because of the way that the institutions work, because of the way that Congress works, because of the way how laws are passed work, because of the party system, that the president actually just kind of sits there and is a symbolic representative of an administration, hence the phrase, the X person's name administration. And that administration is 400, 500 people that are cracking on with their agenda. And the president ultimately has the final say, but that, you know, the reason they've been picked as the presidential candidate is probably because of the fact that their say is aligned with what the projects underneath the surface are inclined to do. The most extreme example of this would be like, to go way back into the history books, would have been like, you know, the JFK disagreeing with, you know, the CIA and having whole separate elements of the state arguing against each other and with each other. So Neustadt's weak presidential approach, or the thesis as well, has been like basically debated for a while. But the one way that you could argue against it would be something to the effect of, how come Trump passed all those laws with those executive orders? Because we had this scenario where Obama won two consecutive terms and ostensibly said you can't do anything without both sides agreeing. And then Trump came in and was like, hand me a pen, I'm just going to pass loads of like constitutionally dubious laws. Mm-hmm. What do we think about the fact that the president seems to be someone is limited and weak, but also kind of strong as well?
Just one thing to go back on equality that I wanted to sort of say as a roundup, because I just think it's really, really useful to think about when we're talking about proactive redress. That the thing about equality and the problem with equality in a democracy is that for there to be greater equality, the people who currently have an unequal amount of power are going to need to have a relative reduction in their power. And the problem with these large systems is that what we've had in the US and in most other systems is a gesticulation towards giving people who are less powerful within the system more power, but that there has been there's not any willingness to reduce the power of the people who have unequal power, so you are not able to achieve equality unless the people that, you know, white educated people like us are willing to lose some of their power in the name of equality.
No, I completely agree.
Back on the weak presidential system. So part of the problem with this, in a way, is that whether the actions of the president, you know, whether these executive orders go into effect, is whether that they are decided that they are constitutional, and whether something is decided to be constitutional or not is, the Supreme Court has now become incredibly politicized, and the nomination of Supreme Court justices, who are the ones who get to decide whether an executive order or even an act of Congress is constitutional, has become an extremely politicized endeavor. And it was seemingly recognized that one of the most effective political strategies for solidifying, you know, political power was to really fight over the election of Supreme Court justices, because they are elected for life. And you can look at, you know, what happened between Obama's nomination of, it was Merrick Garland, right? Who Obama tried to nominate after losing the election, but before the end of his term, and was blocked in Congress, saying that he shouldn't be allowed to nominate for an open Supreme Court seat because he had lost the election and needed to wait until the new president. And then under Trump, it was RBG's seat, I think, who was filled by Amy Coney Barrett.
Well, we got this. Well, I mean, I was going to say this touches on two issues. I mean, the one is just like the gerontocratic nature of America, which is actually unique. Like, unlike European democracies, there tends to be a love of keeping a seat for as long as humanly possible. Because once you win it and it's in a safe seat, you can just keep winning it until you're 89 and you're, you know, stumbling around and your office aides are helping you, you know, write your name and stuff. Which is like a big problem that American politics has had for a while. And the other aspect of this is obviously just like where the money in politics is often associated with like super PACs and, you know, indirectly campaigning for candidates. But there's also stuff like spending a lot of money setting up a think tank to fast track right-wing legal scholars so they can try and become Supreme Court justices one day, right? Yeah. Which is like a massive thing that a lot of the a lot of billionaire donors have done, right? So it's like attacking the state in different ways, using money in these kind of like adjacent spaces in order to kind of undermine the process and concentrate power amongst very tightly situated people in Washington.
I mean, even on this, just I want to talk about money so much, but just as like an academic point on this constitutionality, I think that there is an argument that the entire nature of the Constitution in the US could be seen in some ways as anti-democratic, because everything needing to be justified under a document that's been written, you know, however many hundred years ago, even when that goes against, you know, that yes, there is a lot of leeway around the edges, but this ability to have the excuse to say, no, under this document written hundreds of years ago, before we had the internet, before we had these, you know, global financial systems, we are unable to find a way to justify the law that the democratically elected Congress wants to pass under this founding document. Therefore, you need to go through this incredibly rigorous and extremely difficult process of undergoing a constitutional amendment in order to be able to make that change. So it sets these much higher standards for the exercise of democracy for anything that can't be with fancy footwork justified under the founding document of the Constitution.
No, of course. No. I suppose naturally I'm thinking that, I mean, obviously we've been whinging about how this isn't a democracy and how it sucks and the system's not the way it should be. But then also we have this paradox of the fact that we're also like, and Trump's going to ruin it. Right. Like, you know, the system that we think is super imperfect and, you know, super inhospitable for genuine democratic, you know, representation could also be made worse quite quickly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, potentially this is something that's to be taken seriously. And it reminds me of the Astra Taylor quote, just something to the effect of like, we don't live in a democracy, but we'll miss it when it's gone. And it's this kind of idea of one of the things to keep alive, even in incredibly imperfect systems, is to point out that the reason it's not working is because it's not democratic enough, not because democracy is like the reason for indecision, or it's the reason things are inefficient, or it's the reason that is suboptimal. I think there's a kind of acceptance that the kind of Churchillian idea that like democracy is the least worst system, which I've always hated that quote, because I think people just go, oh yeah, it's rubbish because this is what freedom is, which I think is a very like trite and insubstantive way of looking at it. Because I think, you know, and the other aspect of this is like, why are we whinging? Well, we're whinging because obviously America like influences everywhere. So obviously like it matters not only for the 350 million people that live there, but it also matters for everywhere else, because what their standard of a democracy is, or what their standard of democratic norms, institutional norms, international norms, will come and affect most other countries in the world.
Yeah. But I think also in talking about this Churchill quote and in talking about the way that the US is, you know, setting these democratic norms, it's sort of the time to kind of disambiguate the different kind of democracies that we're talking about. Because while this definition of democracy is that we started with is in some ways like frighteningly simple and doesn't actually, you know, we can envisage non-democracies with the rule of law, we can envisage democracies that don't have free and fair elections because they're not representative democracies, because they're direct democracies, for instance. Mm-hmm. That, you know, the Churchill quote that says, you know, democracy is our least worst system, like belies the fact that we can construct democracy in so many different ways in terms of the definition of the people who are being allowed to rule, in terms of the concessions that are made. You know, I mentioned direct democracy with this idea that everyone can get in a room and discuss it, and therefore you don't need to have free and fair elections for your representatives. And then there are a lot of concessions made in the exercise of democracy when you are electing representatives. And the same when we're talking about like, why are we complaining about, you know, the US, why are we complaining so much about the state of the US's democracy, but at the same time, you know, complaining about what sort of Trump is going to do to it or might do to it. comes back, I think, a lot to this prevailing standard of a liberal democracy. So yeah. Most of the time when we, outside of a very academic frame, and most everyone else out in, you know, a Western democracy, say democracy, mm-hmm. what they mean is a liberal democracy. And so when we're talking about things like what might happen to abortion rights or to marriage equality under Trump, it's technically democratic if 51% of the population say, no, anyone who thinks about having an abortion should be zapped immediately from a death ray in the air. But I shouldn't be giving them ideas, but that we decided that we need to have higher standards than this, and then bolted on all of these other conceptions of to our understanding of democracy, of liberal democracies, which means representative democracies, free and fair elections, minority rights, so you can't have, you know, that there are certain inalienable rights that the people have that can't just be taken away or voted down by, you know, 51% of the population. And this is what many people are worried about when we're talking about what Trump might do is reversing, you know, going against liberal democracy. But then also what we keep saying we're going to complain about but haven't fully got into our complaint about is that, you know, liberal democracy is also, at least now, couched within the assumption of this kind of free market capitalism, and that there are other ways of thinking about democracy that don't take on these similar economic systems, but that when we are using these words now and we're talking about worrying about what might happen to the democracy, we're worried about democracy in this particular conception of a liberal democracy, which the US has done a lot in promoting that as the understanding of democracy, but also more recently is doing very badly at upholding.
On this idea, I suppose that the idea of a liberal democracy is that, I suppose the idea that we were complaining about the historical context is that this idea is quite young and fragile, right? The idea that America is a shining light for liberal rights is like incredibly brand new, basically. Like the second they came up with it, they were telling everybody how great it was, but they came up with it quite late. And so it's quite easy to remove. And that's kind of one of the problems is the fact that, you know, we talk about minority rights and all this kind of stuff. It's like, yeah, America didn't have it for most of its history, got it briefly, and they spent most of the time trying to repeal it. So, you know, there's that kind of aspect to it. And the second aspect of this is like liberal democracy hasn't really existed independent from this idea of enshrining property rights. And that has come before minority rights.
Which is in
often.
Some ways anti-democratic in its pure form, the property rights thing, the inequality thing.
That's, I mean,
but now it's baked into our understanding of democracy.
Well, that's a trend, isn't it? I mean, there's a growing trend, I think, about, well, I mean, we've been looking at global trends. I mean, that's literally what we've been doing the last few months. But there's this global trend to think like, can we do markets without liberalism? Can we have liberalism without democracy? Like, can we untether these things that have been historically, you know, aligned? You know, in the 2000s, it was quite normal to say that, like, you know, that one came with the other. And one of the arguments for the end of history was like, well, if everyone becomes a liberal democracy, it will be great for the markets. And then economists can just dispassionately enjoy democracy for its outcomes rather than because they think it's morally good. And now we're seeing an increasing, like, separation of economic performance and democratic norms, or rather in complete disinterest in upholding democratic norms if there's an opportunity to have a better economic performance. And I think people are sometimes taking the conclusion they're drawing is something like, it costs to be a democracy, so it's actually okay if we lose some of the trappings. Like if we streamline government, I'm doing air quotes, if we streamline the government by getting rid of loads of stuff, loads of protections that basically protect us or ourselves, you know, and we streamline the government, you know, and we treat the state rather as an exceptional place of representation, but instead as like a kind of extension of business logic, that would be better for us in some kind of the long run. And I suppose this is the kind of general post-crash, post-liberal trend that is that I'm concerned about. And I think that if you aren't concerned about it, I think you should be.
but this sort of short-term thinking is one of the problems of democracy, not in general, but as currently, you know, construed and practiced in these dominant countries, in which the dominant countries in shaping our ideas of democracy, in which the power is largely vested in people who are, you know, representatives who are being elected every 4 to 5 years. Sometimes there's a cyclical fashion to where, you know, you're only having like half the seats every election and it's happening every 2 years or something. But in general, like in running a country, these are extremely short timescales. And many places, the US in particular, essentially seems to be on an election footing in the entire time. That it's never about actually implementing what you said you would do or governing, because we now live, I mean, this is another thing to talk about, like the idea of democratic deficit. One of the reasons that we're talking about the US and the US is interesting is because, you know, this idea of democratic deficit is that really government should be happening at the lowest possible level for efficiency. You know, so if we can be deciding school entry criteria and what is on a school curriculum, you know, most effectively at the, you know, at like the level of a city and its, you know, surrounding, you know, more rural areas, then that's where it should happen rather than at a centralized level. So that could be, you know, tailored to the kind of, you know, the needs of the more local population. And so the larger the country you have, the more you have this problem with democratic deficit. You know, there's some questions about whether like a country the size of the US can really effectively be a democracy. You know, the same with India. But
I was just thinking about that in terms of federalization. How much of it's states' rights versus national top-down?
Yeah, and even sort of lower. But what you've seen, in a way, is that these local points of where democracy is being done on a more local level, because we have these like huge systems with these perpetual like election cycles, there is so much media focus on the center, and people sort of run out of energy to be caring, you know, when you're filling out your ballot and you get to who you're electing for like soil and water commissioner and who you're electing to the school board and who you're electing
the
as
coroner,
the
county coroner
chief.
Is like a, you know, option sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. So many of these are elected positions. Attorney general of the states and all this kind of stuff, people are just not paying attention to these races, but then these become areas that can be sort of easily like attacked because they are envisaged as important positions because you're trying to run your government as local to the people as possible. But then because we are in these huge systems, you know, funded by so much money with so much focus on the center, you then have like anti-democratic kind of tendencies at both ends, one in turning the centralized system into basically just a permanent, you know, election and PR show, but then the ability to kind of take the focus off these very important parts where government is actually, where rule and governance is actually taking place, but from the soil and water commissioner and the police chief and everything.
On the idea of this election machine as well, we've seen like Trump doing a kind of permanent campaign thing. He's also kind of awkwardly suggested that he didn't need to do the primaries or even campaign again because he was technically still the president. But putting that kind of alternative reality to the side slightly, there's also this idea of like the election machine. I think there's a really absurd and demonstrable example of that was when they were going through the finances of how Kamala Harris spent $1 billion on her campaign, which is a lot of money, and then Trump spent $1.2 billion but had way fewer donors because Musk put up like $400 million of that or something.
And for out of the goodness of his heart, right?
Exactly, you know, it's like, yeah. And then when they were looking through some journalists were looking through what money had been spent on, there was a large sum of money, something like $80,000 that was, $800,000 I believe. I'll be doing the fact check, don't worry. $800,000 was spent, and the money was spent on advertisements nationwide asking for donations. So, like, the money was spent on getting the money back. And it's kind of like, that's kind of illustrates this kind of the permanent election cycle aspect of this, that, like, substantial amounts of money that could have, like, genuinely affected people, helped people's lives, have gone into ensuring that whoever wins, nothing will change, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, campaign finance is an issue at so many points. You know, if we think about even in the perfect democratic system in which there are no problems with the, you know, the differences between the popular vote and who wins in the Electoral College. There's no problems that we haven't even got to about, you know, the difference between like representation per vote in the Senate between, you know, who, where there are two senators for every state. So the amount of citizens per senator in, I think the smallest is Wyoming, perhaps, compared to, you know, California, like people in Wyoming have just maybe 10 times, something like that. Again, we have to fact check as much like Senate representation as people.
Oh, yeah, and Rhode Island as well.
Oh, yeah, Rhode Island. Well. Yeah, sorry.
Like even more. Even
yeah,
more
Rhode so, Island, yeah. Super tiny as well. But even if we iron out all of these problems, even if we iron out the structural inequality, you know, that different access to being able to vote. I mean, that's another thing. Oh, so many structural, but like the that it's not a public holiday, right?
Yeah.
And so that is makes it much more difficult for people who are working in shift work, who are on it. You know, people who have flexibility in their time scales, much much easier to take time off to go and vote. Yes, polling places can be open before and after business hours, but you often see extremely long lines afterwards. There is a huge difference often in terms of the number, like the number of polling places, the accessibility of polling places between different areas of the population. And I think there are very few sort of regulations around that. You know, India has very strong laws about how far each citizen can be from a polling place that results in these kind of crazy polling places where like five poll workers trek off into the jungle to set up a polling place for literally like two people because you have to be so close to a polling place. Even if we get rid of all of those structural problems, right? All of the information that people going in to vote in a perfect system have underneath the US system comes from the media. Right. Even when it comes directly from a PR release, from a speech, from a campaign, all of this is going through spin. Right. Which I don't know what you believe theoretically, but there is certainly and where we can actually draw the line. But these arguments about whether the attempt to spin and always put a good light on things is, you know, democratic. At all.
Yeah, it depends on, I suppose, yeah, all information is going to be mediated and all communications are going to be like leveraged to try and, you know, persuade in the context of political discourse. But yeah, I definitely agree that there's a disproportionate amount of power given to, you know, large corporate media environments that have their own interests, and there's agenda setting power there, you know, and I think it's very difficult for, you know, anyone to make a decision about how to orient their own interests. And I think there's another aspect to this, which is just simply that sometimes you're choosing the least worst candidate, or you're choosing
just the candidate with the most name recognition.
Yeah, or you're choosing somebody that like you personally identify with for some in some way that you can't quite describe. And you know there's this idea that it's very hard to be a fully oriented citizen generally, even if you're making it your job, right? But let alone if you don't really care and you only care around election time as well, right? You have a very finite time to make this decision on who to vote for. Your vote might not really count for that much anyway. And so you do get this kind of, people have very syncretic and, you know, all over the place views about loads of different things. I mean, to give an idea of when this was recorded, right? We had the CEO, the healthcare CEO, shot in the street, and you know his politics were all over the place. People were like mining for his internet, you know, history and stuff. So yeah, I think most people aren't necessarily like that ideologically rigid in their positions, which again then reinforces this idea of making the media important, because if everybody is still up for grabs, then even more election campaigning, even more moving around the country. So.
But it is like, I mean, this is another thing. I would sort of disagree with that in a way. Like, I know where you're coming from, but I think it's an important point that one thing that is flawed often about democracies is the number of swing voters is incredibly small, right? The by far the biggest predictor of the way that you are going to vote is the way that your parents voted.
Mm-hmm.
And the number of people who kind of substantively change, especially in a short time period, you know, over elections rather than over like huge generations. Like people who are younger tend to vote more left wing than people who are older. But when we're talking about election to election on a cycle of 4 or 5 years or whatever, the number of swing voters that there are incredibly small. And so the population of people that are being fought over is tiny. And then
the number of people who matter as well, right? The other people whose vote matters, right?
Yeah.
And basically, unless you are if you're not a middle income family in Iowa,
yeah,
with a technical degree or something, like, yeah, your vote does not matter really that, yeah, much. I mean, when I talk about people being able to be up for grabs, I'm thinking more in terms of like, will they bother to vote or not?
Right.
So often it's to do with like the reason that Kamala Harris lost, if you want the kind of the headline, it's not because loads of people that were going to vote for them vote for Trump. It's, yeah, more like it's such an effort to vote, wait 6 hours in a queue, you know, negotiate all this stuff, maybe have to take time off work and all this stuff, and it's for somebody I don't even really rate.
Yeah.
And I've been convinced that the other option isn't that terrible. Well, I'll just stay at home, you know. Yeah. And I think that's often it's the mobilization more than persuasion in the, yeah, end of the day.
And this was one of the many interesting and weird points in the Bush-Gore Florida election.
Oh, classic.
going back to a classic problem.
Classic anti-democratic law.
But that the election was first called, Florida was first called for Gore before the polls in the panhandle closed. So one of the arguments of the Bush team was that this decision influenced the election because people who were heading out to vote in the panhandle before the polls closed in the last couple of hours, the media networks had already called the state for Gore, and so that it would and then they called it for Trump, and then they called it for, sorry, then they called, yeah, it for, well, Bush, yeah, and then they called it for Gore again, they called, yeah, it for Bush again. Or, you know, we're not gonna get into that one because that's history, but just in terms of thinking about like turnout, you know, this turnout issue, and again, like, is this how we want democracies to function? It's less about convincing voters who to vote for and who is the party or the candidate who has the best policies, who's going to represent you the best. It's really about convincing people that this is such an important election that they need to go to the trouble of going out to vote. Again, you know, like an easy, like Australia, I believe, has, you know, the election as a national holiday.
Yeah, it's mandatory as well, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's, yeah, voting is mandatory. Well, going to the election booth is mandatory.
Yeah.
You don't have to vote for a candidate. You can spoil your ballot or vote for nobody, but you have to go vote. Although I don't think it's enforced. I don't think you end up thrown in prison for not doing it. But
okay, so what can we take from this, I suppose? So, okay, let's say, well, obviously the US is an immensely imperfect example of a democracy, but it's still considered a democracy. And it is, at the time of recording, has yet to collapse into anything. That,
you know. It was downgraded from a full democracy to a flawed democracy by some official estimates after the election of Trump and crackdown on media reporting.
Those pesky liberals in the, yeah, academia getting in his way.
Yeah.
Well, let's hope it doesn't. Well, let's hope that it survives. You know, the Trump's second regime. On that note, what can we kind of take away from this? So what kind of things do we want democracies to be able to achieve? What kind of things do democracies need to watch out for when they're being, you know, criticized? You know, this, what kind of things can we do to make sure that, you know, if Americans go, okay, cool, it's rubbish, now what do we do?
Well, I think my one of the biggest takeaways is that democracy, if you're not paying attention, democracy under Trump is not going to collapse. It's going to be redefined. I mean, one of my specialist areas is politics in China, which is not a democracy, but officially defines itself as a people's democratic dictatorship in some contexts. And you can make an argument that without voting, you know, you're representing the needs of the people in completely different ways. So what we are not going to see is this complete collapse of democracy in the US, what we might see and what we are paying attention to is the way that democracy is defined, who it's for, what it does, the way it's functioning is being reconfigured And that's what I think one of my messages is to pay attention to. It's not, we're not going to say, oh, you know, democracy has collapsed. What we're going to say is democracy has been fundamentally changed. And it can be fundamentally changed in a way that supports democratic principles like free and fair elections, like equality, like the rule of law, or we're more worried about, in many cases, it being changed, the understanding of what democracy is in the US and how that structurally works being changed such that those principles are undermined.
Mm. Things that were previously given are now first treated as privileges, then entitlements, and then you asking for too much. And then next thing you know, yeah, the exclusionary discourse begins and continues unabated. And then, as you say, we have a democracy, but it's for, you know, for whom and to what end?
Yep.
With that in mind, is there any homework that we want to give these people over to reflect on this journey that we've taken them through?
So mine would be a thought exercise that, and I'm really keen on telling my students in classes that they need to sit down and, you know, think very hard about their values and make commitments to themselves. And often in class we do this publicly, but you can on a podcast do it publicly. I think one of the really, really key things that I live by and think by is that these slides towards authoritarianism, towards suppression of minority rights, you know, towards internment, you know, towards segregation, you know, institutionalized segregation. These things don't happen dramatically. They happen in tiny little steps. And that part of the problem for people living through that is that each individual little step seems justified and only a small step from where we were. So I think that for every individual, it is important to sit down and draw some red lines that you would say, if we pass this point, regardless of whether it was a small step from where we were before, this is the point at which I take action. You know, this is the point at which I can't pretend to be living a normal life anymore because the repression of minority rights, because the movement away from, you know, free and fair elections, because of the, you know, undue inequality, influence of money within the political system has become too much. If each individual doesn't have that, then it's really very difficult to motivate for action against negative change, the change that individual doesn't believe in, until they actually come for you, you know? And so that would be my assessment. And I honestly believe that if people had sat down and done that, people in the US had sat down and done that, I don't know, if you had that 10 years ago, many people's red lines would have already been passed. So that's my that's my homework, to sit down and really think about that and keep that with you. What are your red lines that you would not allow to be passed before you took action to prevent this slide towards authoritarianism?
And I think I'd recommend the songs of Pete Seeger. I think that would be a nice little combination of the two, like kind of a, you know, 60s like folk like political songs to listen to while thinking about your values. I think it's a nice little compliment.
Thanks
for listening to Civics and Cynics. For fact-checking, clarification, elaboration, references to all journal articles mentioned, and all the other forms of academic pedantry that undergird our boring yet important work, check out the Path to Power website and podcast description.